This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Stay safe. Don't die, or I will kill you.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 627 for the week of August 10th, 2026. I am mirror to self banana peel, David T. Cole, and I'm here with backcountry monk, Sarah D. Bunting.
She's not the guy.
Sexual Blundstone star Ariano.
Ooh, rugged.
And unjustly accused mountain lion, Omar Gallego.
Hey, her throat was slit when I got here. I gotta go.
Yeah.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, he is a journalist, critic, and national parks enthusiast. You have heard with us many times before. It's Omar Gallego.
Welcome back, Omar.
Hi, everybody.
We are here to talk about Anna Pigeon, in which a park ranger named Sheila goes missing in Glacier National Park. Whereupon, United States Park Police Officer Anna Pigeon.
I'm sorry. I thought that was going to be, I didn't want to push it.
Tracy,
if you want that every time somebody says Anna Pigeon, consider it done. My treat.
Anna Pigeon.
Just expecting it. Anyway, she's played by Tracy Spiridakos. Anna Pigeon finds Sheila. She can tell that Sheila was not killed by a mountain lion. She was killed by people. Trying to convince her colleagues of that, however, at least gives Anna a break from trying to dull her memories of her old life with her now dead husband, Zach, which she dulls by drinking and hooking up with a local bartender whose name she does not learn until quite late in the episode. Morwen Brebner adapted the show from the Anna Pigeon book series by Nevada Barr. It became Bell Media's first co-commission with the USA Network, meaning it was made in and mostly by Canadians. I mean, in Canada, mostly by Canadians, not in Canadians. Only the first episode has aired so far on the USA Network. We got access to the first six. We will be careful about spoilers, theoretically. Let's do the Chen check-in. Omar, should our listeners watch Anna Pigeon?
Qualified, yes.
Sarah.
You don't have to call for an airlift out of the room if it's on, but nope.
Dave.
I think this will appeal to people that miss a certain type of show, but it's not like the best of breed of that sort of blue skies adjacent programming.
If you are my mother, and one of you is, you should watch this show.
100%. Yeah.
Everyone else.
This one's for you, Mom.
You can skip it.
My parents saw the pilot and loved it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
This is, parent nip.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's get into it. When I was trying to decide who would be a good guest for this episode, I thought of Omar because I believe he is our outdoorsiest friend. And that turned out to be true when I texted him about it and he responded, from Glacier National Park.
Yeah.
Omar, how was your trip and how many dead bodies did you find while you were there?
And how long did it take you to get there after you learned we were going to invite you on so that you could be like this big show off?
Booked a trip to Missoula, drove 3 hours up. No, yeah, we were literally about to get on a raft to do some whitewater rafting.
That's crazy.
In Glacier when I got the text. Mm-hmm. We were just there. It just happened to line up perfectly that the show comes out. I am disappointed that I heard that the show was coming. I didn't know it was taking place at Glacier. Mm-hmm. And there was no signage, no t-shirts, no tote bags.
Yeah.
Nothing at Glacier National Park to give you any indication that this TV show was on deck.
Right.
Like, what a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think they fudge it. Obviously, like I said, they shot it in Canada. They shot it in Alberta. But they also like fudge it in the sense that she works for the, in this show, the parks are administered by the Federal Parks Agency or something, which is not real, like similar to how various productions have to be like, it's the U.S. mail. It's not the U.S. Postal Service because they don't have the rights to that.
O.R. at the end of Glacier. We see you, Anna Pigeon.
But the signs did look right. Like when the parking lot signs looked like that is the font that they use in national parks.
The look of it was fine.
Yeah.
I was at Glacier and you could have fooled me. Like that all looked like scenery that similar to what we saw. So well, yeah, it was, I was fooled.
Yeah. Alberta's not that far.
No,
yeah.
Alberta's above part of Montana.
Yeah. It sits on top of Montana like Master Blaster.
Exactly. But Omar, to be serious, as someone who has visited many state and national parks, what would you think are the storytelling opportunities for a show like this, and where did the pilot meet them, and where did it let you down?
National parks are awesome. I've actually haven't been to that many, but the ones I've been to, I mean, I think the show kind of captures the culture of, you know, the park rangers. They're just trying to, you know, keep the park clean and keep it orderly and not have people be, you know, jerks about littering and things like that. There's a lot of that in the show. Is there a murder or a caper or some sort of, you know, something happening every single week at one national park? Probably not. Mm-hmm. And maybe that has something to do with why the show doesn't tie so closely to the official park, is that they don't want people thinking that you're going to get murdered or kidnapped or thrown in a hole every episode. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of a show set at a national park. I think that's a great setting. There's lots of cool ideas around that. And I even like the sort of office environment of it, you know, where you see her, you know, her coworkers and their interactions. Like, it reminded me a little of North by North. Kind of the interactions with the coworkers North of North, yes. Mm-hmm. Which please come back. I want that show back.
It's coming back.
So those parts I really liked. I liked the supporting character, but as far as does it really capture the vibe of national parks? I think so. If you're into hiking, if you're into the outdoors, if you want to see pretty shots of lakes and trees, like there's a lot of that in the show. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it's a procedural. And if you're not into those type of shows, which I'm typically not, it's not really going to be your jam. But I liked it enough that I would keep watching.
Yeah, the first episode is about a ne'er-do-well who wants to, I don't know, like mustache twirly control the national park system or something. I didn't quite understand.
Oh, the national park, like, how?
It was ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Played by Kim Coates. So you know he's evil because he's Kim Coates, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, like, beyond that, beyond him being set up as the nemesis for Anna Pigeon, like, what else can we do? Like, I was trying to make a list as soon as you said that to Omar, like, dumb tourists, that's probably going to be in every episode. Probably not the thrust of it, something.
Yeah.
Fires.
Yes.
Animals.
Yes.
Perhaps a super volcano. But what else are we actually going to do as the background for an episode?
Rock slide.
Bear attack.
Poaching. Mm-hmm. Dead drops. For all various other capers. I listed this in our doc, and hopefully it'll be in the show notes. Mm-hmm. There's a book by John Billman called The Cold Vanish, Seeking the Missing in North America's Wildlands. And he just sort of went into the interior at various parks, was trying to figure out, like, first of all, how many missing persons cases in the parks are crimes, and why do we want it to be true crime versus, it's like Mara Murray, like, sometimes people just get hit on the head, wander into the interior and die there.
Is this sort of like the I can't afford a cruise ship to get rid of somebody, so we'll just go to a park? Is that kind of the deal?
There's enough cases like that where it's like, let's us estranged people who never hike go on a hike or row a boat or whatever it is. But I think there's adequate, like, process, at least based on the first episode, that it's like, well, this could look like a crime, but here's how we would know that it was actually wildlife.
Right. I will say, I just finished reading a story in a recent New Yorker about what is termed alpine divorce, which is an experienced mountain climber and a less experienced spouse go up a mountain together and only one of them comes down. And apparently it's enough of a thing in Austria, which is where this case in the article took place, that, you know, there's a special court that is just for, like, mountain crimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do they have in the courtroom, is there a scaling wheel for demonstrations and exhibits?
They did not drill down that far, but the judge is, like, an experienced climber. So, knows what questions to ask and stuff. Isn't that cool?
Crazy.
They should make a movie of that.
That's
in
great.
My opinion.
So, yeah, but this could be cool in that sort of, like, backcountry CSI way that CSI was, like, completely new information to basically everyone for, like, 2.5 seasons. And it's like, oh, well, how would you figure out the difference here? Or how could you use litter to track a poacher or whatever? Awesome.
Just to go back to Tara's thing, if we can have the Alpine divorce judge show, mm-hmm. I want his wife to be a food flavor scientist, which is the other thing I always thought would make a great show.
Yeah.
Let's combine them and make one mega weird interest show.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your time, Omar.
Well, the thing is, even just driving up there, you know, we had to drive 2-3 hours to get to some of these hikes. And I don't think people who haven't been to a national park of this size understand the scale of a glacier national park. Mm-hmm. It's huge. It's hundreds of miles. And when you're driving up there, you're on these, you know, windy cliff roads, like where there's hardly any barrier. I mean, it's very easy to picture your car going over, you know, a staged car accident, or, you know, just going over the cliff. Hiking is dangerous. You know, you're on these very tall, narrow paths where you can easily just fall over. Like it's your life is in danger a lot more of the time than most people would probably be comfortable with.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that as soon as you get 300 yards away from the cabin visitor center, it's sort of you're on your own. There's no more barriers. There's no more ropes. It's sort of like when you go to Iceland and the whole country's like that. They're like, here's a volcano. You just park right next to the volcano.
There's no railing.
Don't get out of your car on the other side. Get out of your car on this side. Is it like, so is that up 10 times over?
Yeah.
And on top of that, no cell service.
Right. Right. So if you fall, you're fucked, right? Unless you got a satellite phone or something like that. Yeah, no, I think it's easy when you're just sort of like doing a road trip or something. And you're like, I went to Yellowstone. Oh, yeah, what do you do? Well, I parked next to Old Faithful and saw that. I went to the weird pools that are all different colors.
Yeah.
You know, walked around the ropes on that one. And then we had to get on our way. Well, that's not really seeing the national park in the same way.
No.
Yeah. Well, and never underestimate the ability of people to think that they will be fine in a pair of Converse.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Or flip-flops is what we would say a lot in Hawaii.
So that's what I mean. I think like for this show that the dumb tourist will be the catalyst for everything that happens. You know, the adventure begins with the dumb person doing this, you know, slipping on their Converse, you know, head first into the gooey whatevers.
Yeah.
And then we go from there.
But... And then you find skeletonized remains from like the 60s. And then you could do a like historical murder mystery or, you know, it's the remains of that guy who disappeared in the 30s. There is material here.
Yeah.
The lead is fairly likable. I don't think it's like willing to commit to either the national parkiness or the procedurality enough. So it's a little bit in the middle.
So I have a representative clip, and I think we can probably be generous about how annoying it must be to write a pilot and all the information like you have to get in it.
Yeah.
But there are limits to the grace that I think all of us can offer. Anna Pigeon tests them almost immediately. This is from the second scene after the cold open. Dave, please play my extra clip.
How's New York? I know I've said this to you before, but I'm worried about you.
Molly,
I gotta go look for a missing park ranger, my friend.
Who's probably stuck in a crevice with her leg under a rock. Don't shrink me right now.
It's Zach's birthday this week.
Yeah, I know. I was married to him. I literally never forget.
How are you going to get through this week?
You know, work and wine.
Besides, I'm leaving in 2 weeks.
Okay, goodbye, Anna Pigeon.
Yeah, don't shrink me, sis. Like, that was so awkward. Oh. And, like, even Canadians don't watch Canadian TV shows by and large. And it's because most of them seem like this, like they were written by high schoolers. So, Sarah, was this another aspect of this that bothered you?
Not really. Like, I was grading on a curve for that. At least I had sort of a grudging respect for like how blatant it was and how it was immediately like hanging a light on itself, that Anna Pigeon is like, yeah, I'm aware I was married to him. Mm-hmm. There's another part in the same episode where there's a whole lot of like, behold me, widow.
Yes.
Not dealing with her trauma. Ex-boss packed into 14 seconds that you're like, well, at least they're just getting this done. It's inelegant, but it's done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing I did like is that it knows that it's that. It knows that it's not prestige TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not true.
Its
reach doesn't exceed its grasp. It's not trying to be prestige TV. And it doesn't do the, you know, 3 days earlier, you know, start you from the, you know, they're just not doing any of that junk.
True.
Good point.
True. The titular Anna, though, to Sarah's point, is very 2020s kind of capital SFC strong female character, meaning She drinks. She has, you know, no strings attached sex. She doesn't want to make friends with her coworkers. She keeps moving from job to job because she doesn't want to stay anywhere. Did anyone feel, I mean, Sarah, you said she was likable, but there was a spark in Winnipeg's own Tracy Spiridakos, who plays her, that suggested she might transcend the cliches she's been saddled with as this goes on?
I don't know anything about the books, but I suspect that's exactly what the character is supposed to be, so get ready for more of it.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, these shows aren't very challenging. I think one of the hallmarks of them is you don't see a lot of character development. Mm-hmm. The character you get in episode one is pretty close to the character you get in the last episode, whenever that wraps up.
Yeah. Well, and this is why I made the Monk comp, but you could also say Kay Scarpetta, I guess. Book version, not TV. Yeah, any sort of anti-heroine aspects of her are very gentle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nice to see Willie Jack from Res Dogs, but... And that sort of was like, oh, maybe I should hang on with this. But it's also like, I don't know, if it's on, I'm not going to run away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not necessarily going to seek it out either.
Sure. I think on Extra Extra, great. I think it's already happened. Doesn't matter anyways. Somebody asked a question about, do you remember Peacemakers, the Old West version of CSI? And we're like, yes, of course we do. Tom Berenger, yes. If this was more of that sort of semi-bonkers CSI take on it, while still being this blue sky mood, so like take away the night shift feeling of CSI. And it doesn't need to be like high tech, but I just mean it's more of a physical examination of things, as it plays a lot more into it. Mm-hmm. But also they lend themselves to the occasional 911 Lone Star-esque fanciful trip.
Sure.
That feels like a better sell to me than what we ended up with. Granted, not exactly the target they're going for, but that's how I would have remixed it to make it a little more appealing.
Yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm. My number one reason to keep watching the show is Paulina Alexis from Willie Jack from Reservation Dogs. I think she's wonderful. Every time I see her on screen, I light up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this isn't a spoiler, but, you know, I watched all six episodes and she does get stuff to do.
Oh, good.
In subsequent episodes, you know, she gets her little moments and gets to be funny and gets to wisecrack a little bit. And, you know, all those moments were appreciated. And I think most of the supporting cast is pretty appealing. Like, I liked enough of them to want to keep watching and see what they're up to, too.
I'm never going to warm to a Jeff with a G. Sorry to any who are listening, but anyway.
That's why when you say your name is Jeff, she pauses for a second, just whispers, J or G.
To wrap up, I love the idea of a cop procedural that at least tries to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. The idea of it, if not the execution in this case, I looked up a list of private police forces that might make more interesting shows than this. So do any aspiring TV writers in our audience hear some ideas? Various railroads have their own police forces, various colleges and universities, of course. The Coal and Iron Police is now defunct, but you could do a period piece. That would be cool. Ditto the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company if you want to get the product placement built in.
They're after our blimp.
Yep. I would accept a show about the Pinkertons if it was told from the POV of the labor organizers that they were trying to bust up and or kill.
Yeah.
The Smithsonian has its own police force, I believe under the aegis of the Park Service, but I'm not 100 on that. And then I discovered this, guys. NASA has an Office of Protective Services. Let's see NCIS, but with space crime. That would be so good.
Okay, here's the scene, though. They're on the shuttle. Something bad's happened. You know, an astronaut is now dead. And they just hear this knock, knock, knock. And there's a guy doing a spacewalk. And he shows his badge through the tiny little window in the cockpit.
We cracked it.
Got a lot of shows. A great time for shows.
All right, it's time to go around the dial. First up, Tara Ariano.
Yes, I watched The Last House. This is the Netflix movie. It dropped last week. It stars one Oscar nominee, Wagner Moura, and one person generally agreed to have been viciously snubbed of an Oscar nomination for past lives, Greta Lee. They play Jason and Anna, husband and wife. They share a house in Seattle with their tween son, Gray, and their pre-tween daughter, Ruth, played by some kids. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's a perfectly normal day. Near Christmas, before Christmas, Jason gets back from a bad fishing outing to see the garage door weirdly will not open. When he gets inside, the kids alert the parents. The internet is out. They figure it's no big deal, turn it off and on. Then it starts to rain. Also no big deal at Seattle. Moments later, one of them tries to open the front door. It won't open. They can't open any of the other doors or windows. Jason takes a fireplace poker to a couple of the windows to try to break out that way. They only crack, and then it seems like the creepy rain sort of glues the cracks together. No one else on the street can get out either, as they learn when they start communicating via chalkboards against the picture windows and such. And at first they just figure it's a freak weather event or something. Help will be coming soon. It's not. Here's where I'm going to start spoiling the movie.
Spoilers ahoy.
Thank you. It turns into months and then years of being stuck in the house while all of their neighbors die, and starts a hydroponic farm with what's left of the last vegetables. They dig out the DVD player. They rewatch the only two pieces of physical media they have, which are Annie and Air Force One. Ruth, the too wise child, notices one day that some of the raindrops like follow her pencil crayon on the window as if it has some kind of intelligence. She also says she sees someone outside in the rain and that she seems nice, but Ruth is just a kid. No one believes her. By now, everyone knows I would kill myself in this scenario. I would not still be around in a month or months, or as we eventually see in this case, years. But I guess it's like The Handmaid's Tale also showed us parents can't just kill themselves to avoid the apocalypse. They have to stick around for their dumb wiener kids. This is pretty far down the list of reasons that parenting is a scam. It is on the list, though. The team that brought this movie to fruition saw my ass coming, because they also give the family a very sweet, very old golden retriever doggy named Cassidy. I won't go into specifics because I cared more about this dog than I did about any of the people, but he has heart medicine and it eventually runs out. And this is where the fact that Jason bought a gun at some point before the events of the movie comes into play. It takes so long for us to even see the monsters. I guess we're born from the crazy glue rain or whatever, but it's a multiple Cthulhu situation. One gets in the house a second time. They tie it up. Ruth convinces Jason not to kill it. It opens the door. It stops four other Cthulhus from killing the family, whose house falls into a sinkhole basically as soon as they get out of it. Then they take a neighbor's boat. They set out on the ocean that has risen most of the way up the Space Needle, because supposedly, I guess it's better to be trapped on a boat than trapped in a house. Not that the house still exists. In the last second, they get a radio message back from someone else. But if there's a Laster house, I will not be watching. Long story short, if you get trapped in your house without the internet or TV, see if you can survive for a reasonable length of time. For me, that is 18 to 24 hours. Then before the gas and power go out, you know what to do. And if you say, I have kids, your kids don't want to grow up in that world. Trust me.
Oh my goodness. I thought it was a home invasion movie.
Nope.
Which... I guess
it is in a sense, just not the standard kind of, yeah. For my plug, the Listen to Sassy Club, listentosassy.com/club. This is where you get, among other perks, the full issue scans of every issue of Sassy as we talk about it. And get excited, because our next episode is the November 1991 pop culture episode. Yes, that is the issue with Jason Priestley on the front. So you know we booked Sarity Bunting to come on one of our very first ever guests.
It was an honor.
The third overall. So we talked about that and much more. So listen to sassy.com/club for that.
Omar, what do you got for us? X-Men. X-Men 97.
Is Birdman in the X-Files? The X-Men? Is that one? No, he's DC, isn't he? Sorry.
Hawkman,
that's right.
They need an Anna Pigeon on X-Men. Mm. So, thank you. I only said it for that. Mm-hmm. So, X-Men 97 on Disney Plus debuted a couple years ago and is probably known as well for being a really good update adaptation of the 90s Saturday morning animated series. As for the behind-the-scenes drama, the showrunner, Beau DeMaio, who wrote a lot of the episodes, in the first two seasons was dismissed by Disney for reasons. There was a dispute back and forth about that. So that kind of overshadowed a lot of the first season as people wondered, is it going to be just as good the second season? Given that Bo DiMaio wrote a lot of the season two episodes at the same time as the season one episodes, there's been pretty good continuity. I think the quality is just as good for the second season. I'm not a big X-Men person. I never read the comics. I know them from, you know, the movies and some of the other adaptations. So I'm not like your X-Men guy, but I found the first season to be really compelling. The whole X-Men thing is allegories. Like there's like a Malcolm X, Martin Luther King kind of dynamic between Magneto and Professor X, which is interesting and explored in the first season. The second season largely focuses on a villain named Apocalypse, who has been a villain through multiple eras of time. There's time travel. If you don't like that, you might not like that. Really more complex storylines than what you'd expect from an animated series, even if you're not a big X-Men person, because there's a lot of references to storylines and characters that I don't know anything about, not being an X-Men person. But it's good. It's really entertaining. It's very well done and smart. A lot of smart thinking behind the show. So worth catching up on.
Do they still have the character whose superpower is I can make fireworks?
You know, Jubilee is sort of the central character on the show. She's a teenager, but she's a 90s teenager. She has the Walkman and she likes to go to the mall, and really humanizes the show and is a good access point. And her fireworks actually are quite deadly. Like she actually, there is a scene in the second season, I'm glad you brought this up, where she does a battle scene against a bunch of thugs to the tune of a Veruca Salt's Volcano Girls. And
ooh,
it is badass. It's in the second episode of the second season.
Because usually when you get a character like that, the solution is, oh no, the July 4th fireworks display is being threatened by Cobra and the rain machine. And they're like, oh,
no, her fireworks do real damage, and they made her a really pretty awesome
Isn't she also a vampire
character.
Or something? Maybe not in the cartoon, but I think like they just kept on adding power lets to her, and now she's just like a mishmash of things.
Yeah, this character came back as a horseman of the apocalypse, literally. Yeah, there's a lot going on, but they do a good job just balancing the huge stable of characters, Storm, Cyclops, Wolverine, all these characters, and giving them all something to do and making compelling storylines that actually have resonance with the real world. There's a real big immigration kind of angle to the story and the othering of X-Men, you know, mutants versus humans, and how do we coexist? Like there's a lot going on. And
do they do the thing where it's like X-Men have their own island and with hookers and blackjack?
They do. And a big central storyline of the first season was that it is attacked and basically leveled by forces. And then that becomes sort of their 9/11.
Right, you know? Right.
Before you do your plug, there's a piece at Vanity Fair very recently about the whole Bo DiMaio getting fired debacle. So we'll link that in the show notes as well.
I would not be surprised, given Marvel's recent track record with Wonder Man and other shows like that, if they just canceled it after the two seasons, like even though it seems to be a big hit. I would not be surprised if they just said, we're just going to pause it here and leave it until we figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
I still write a lot of tech stuff for CNET, almost on the daily, Monday through Friday. A lot of kind of newsy tech stuff about flock cameras and what Tesla shenanigans up to lately. So you can find all of my stuff at CNET. That's where I do most of my tech writing these days.
Sarah D. Bunting, what have you been watching?
In addition to Anna Pigeon, at bestevidence.fyi, we keep a spreadsheet of recent and imminent true crime properties. Eve Beatty and I, titles, premiere dates, whether we had screeners, the huge. And there's a notes column in that spreadsheet. And next to Dame Day Murders, mine was, Shaq, what are you doing? I still do not have an answer to that after watching the first episode.
Sorry, did he kill somebody?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. A little confused, but could proceed.
I'll get to it. Okay. A Killer Recruit, the show premiered with that episode July 24th on Investigation Discovery and did literally every single thing you would expect from a reheated exploration of, quote, the deadly intersection of sports and crime, to the point where I got up during a commercial to clean my office refrigerator and did not turn back around, didn't have to. Well-known case in the subgenre, covered more thoughtfully elsewhere, check. Barely a pun episode title, check. Unfocused slow-mo reenactments and mercilessly repeated photo assets, check. Listless pacing that does nothing to discourage second screen searching on Reddit, check-a-dee-doo-dah. This is perfectly predictable. We all know why Game Day Murders and shows like it exist. We all know how they will exist in the world. The calories might be empty, but they will be consumed in a waiting room somewhere, et cetera, and so on. What I don't get is why Shaq had to make this and why he had to make this. Like, taking the second part first, Shaquille O'Neal is democratically unchoosy in his television ad appearances, maybe, if we could put it like that. So that he would decide he wanted to put his name on a true crime thing and then not be especially troubled that it's Garbaggio is not information we need to be sitting down to receive. It's also not that hard to imagine the conversation that led to this, something like him mentioning to his team that he wanted to make the kind of true crime he himself is compelled by, and the team defaulting to, oh, such and so knows a guy at ID, I'll make a call. And then once the project is at ID, it's an ID project. It's not exactly a genre outrage, but the thing is, he told interviewers which specific projects inspired him to get into this genre. They're projects I also admired and reviewed well, so why settle for making this, C, and why not actually make a show that he wants to work on that only he could make? He's not the host of this. He doesn't do VO. He isn't off camera in interviews. Nothing. The man played college ball. He was in the NBA. Doi. Documentaries about him exist. He has relevant insight into topic and into build. He is a personable figure in the culture. He could easily move into a Hillary Burton Morgan type of lane. An investigative series with a little practice. He could iterate on other basketball documentaries. There is material here, but the true crime series he wanted to executive produce in his one tall, precious life is this. It just really seems like a waste. It's not the only missed opportunity here. It's not like unwatchably poor, but that's like 90% of what's on basic cable in this genre at any given time. It's not good enough. Shaq, expect better of yourself and get out of those general commercials while you're up. They're beneath you.
I'm sorry that the show is bad, but his gummies are very good.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, if he's putting his real energy into that, I have no choice, etc.
He should focus on those.
My full review at Best Evidence talks about it more. You will find that in the show notes. But my actual plug is my legal spouse, Dan Patrick Brady. He is in a new noir play. It's called The Bathroom Attendant. He is the titular attendant. It goes up Thursday the 13th, and it runs through the 30th of this month. If you like baseball or blackmail plots or trying to spot which of the props came from our house or were made by me using a Louisville Slugger and a Sharpie, you should check it out. Link in the show notes to that as well.
Woo. All right, here's what's coming up on Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday for club members. We're going to be talking about season 4 of Reacher, The Man Who Reaches. Now, Tara's already watched the whole season. I've so far only watched the first few, but I can tell you the thrust of the season of Reacher is that he always has sassy answers to cops' questions.
He is so much funnier in this season than he ever has been before, or that I remember him being.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yes. There's an interrogation scene between, you know, the good cop, bad cop, and one of the cops says, "Do you think I'm stupid?" He's just like, "Yes."
Most cops are, like, he says. It's great.
Gorgeous.
Sarah, you're in for something. This season takes place in Philadelphia.
Ooh.
So,
yes. All right. I'll get a water ice and check it out.
Philadelphia.
It's filmed in Toronto. Toronto is pretending to be Philadelphia. Yeah. But although there are a couple, I can say, this is not very spoilery, they did shoot on location for a couple of scenes of like local color. And that was also
fight at the big cheesesteak sandwich factory.
You're close.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It creates another crack in the Liberty Bell, slamming some goon's head against it.
Cannot confirm or deny.
Okay. So that is available this Friday. Reacher plus so much more. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join and then come back here. Next week, we're going to be talking about Lanterns, the comic book show, not just the thing that gives you light. We're welcoming back after a too long absence, Kate Sanchez, to guide us through that one.
Hey, before your Q3 call, I've got the campaign brief ready. built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Great. Did you include the differentiation angle the CMO asked for?
Already in there. Three angles no competitor's using right now. Just need your approval.
Approved. Thanks. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our good friend Omar. Omar, take it away.
Hi, Dave. Hello, esteemed panel. Today I am nominating Primal, Season 1, Episode 7, Plague of Madness to the canon. Primal is an animated show from Samurai Jack and Star Wars The Clone Wars creator Genndy Tartakovsky that debuted on Adult Swim in 2019 and ran for 3 seasons, just concluding its improbable 30-episode run this last March. The basic story is about a Neanderthal named Spear and a T-Rex named Fang. Yes, Fang is a female dinosaur who becomes Spear's companion and unofficial life partner after they each suffer the traumatic loss of their families in the first episode and decide that they're pretty good at keeping each other alive. From there, it's a story of survival, kinship, and eventually, as the seasons go on, the nature of life itself. But the first season is largely about Spear and Fang navigating an incredibly unforgiving and brutal world of dangerous creatures, evil forces, and surprising discoveries. Like some of other Tartakovsky's work, there's almost no dialogue in the show. The storytelling is done entirely with stunning visuals, lots of action, and expressive grunting and facial expressions from its characters, even Fang. That makes it a challenge to pitch in the famously visual medium of podcasting, but luckily the show's music and sound design are just as top-notch as what's on screen. Plague of Madness, the 7th episode of the first season, begins calmly with a herd of gentle Argentinosauruses, not brontosauruses like I thought, I had to look it up, in a field munching on their greens and minding their own business. It's beautiful and peaceful. Two dinosaurs even nuzzle their long necks together. But the peace never lasts long on Primal. One of the majestic dinos is interrupted by a pesky Parasaurolophus.
Yep. Nailed it.
Parasaurolophus.
Paras sort of not going to work here anymore.
Parasaurolophus. Salophilus. A little yappy green dinosaur with its flesh coming off and obviously suffering from some terrible disease. The larger dinosaur tries to ignore it, but ends up getting bitten in the leg by this dying pest. And I think you probably know where this is going next. Very soon, the injured Argentinosaurus is diseased too, trying to drink water and feel better, but vomiting blood into the community pond and crushing nests of eggs. It attacks the rest of the herd, and soon they're all dead or dying. It's graphic and terrifying, with the animation sparing no grisly detail or bodily fluid as the carnage takes place. Even for a show that regularly shows us blood and guts and grisly fights, this episode's portrayal of pestilence is extremely affecting and super disturbing. Not long after the herd is decimated, our heroes Spear and Fang come upon the scene. They're horrified by what they see. But just as they're trying to process what they've witnessed, Spear steps on some crushed eggs, and that might be what awakens the last disease survivor, who suddenly towers over them and gives chase. The music and sound effects convey the pulse-pounding panic as Spear and Fang run through the woods just trying to get away. The diseased dino won't stop, pursuing them down a rocky cliff and finally tumbling to the bottom of a crevasse before getting up again for one more jump scare and then collapsing. Spear and Fang lie down, exhausted. As they sleep, Spear has a terrifying dream of his own body melting to skeletal form and Fang dying of disease. We didn't know it at the time, but this would foreshadow some of the surprising turns that Primal would take in its later seasons. When they awakened, Spear and Fang try to decide if they should sneak past the seemingly dead dinosaur with what passes for communication between the two of them. They don't get off that easily, though, as the Argentinosaurus wakes up and chases them some more, eventually leading to a lava pit, where, after more dodges and chasing, it catches fire as it tries one last time to do harm to our heroes. When the dinosaur finally melts into ash, Spear and Fang don't celebrate their victory or collapse in relief. They just stare sadly at the floating embers. Spear catches one in his hand as it goes from bright orange to dead gray. We end on that somber note. Plague of Madness is a fan favorite among people who love Primal, and the episode earned Tartakovsky an Emmy win for Outstanding Animated Program. Some of that might have to do with the timing. The show's first season was split into 2 parts, and this episode aired in April of 2020. The theme of a terrifying disease spreading quickly and wreaking havoc resonated pretty hard at that moment, and the show as a whole felt very apropos at the time with its warnings about the dangers of nature and how little control we have over it. It's not an episode that conveys the breadth of what Primal does well. There are episodes that are much more emotional, showing the growing bond between Spear and Fang, and it often does so with very clever visual humor. And there are episodes that have a bigger human element, especially as the world of Primal expands beyond its two main characters. But Plague of Madness stands out as a superb animation showcase of its own. It's dynamic and affecting. It mixes moments of incredibly kinetic brutality with moments of quiet contemplation and beauty. It's tragic. It pulls no punches. It leaves us with haunting, indelible imagery that you won't soon forget. Primal ultimately is a show about the lengths we'll go to survive and how important it is to not go it alone. And none of that is meaningful if it doesn't also show us how awful and scary it is to die a terrible death as the last of your kind, like that poor giant dinosaur. Genndy Tartakovsky's next project is an animated take on Conan the Barbarian, something he's been pitching for decades. After you've seen Primal, it's hard to imagine anyone better to take on Conan. That's the pitch.
Thank you, Omar. Sarah, you are more conversant with the work of Genndy Tartakovsky, so why don't you go first?
I had forgotten that this existed, and I definitely wanted to keep going with the series or to start at the beginning after I had finished this episode, despite the fact that it was really kind of exhausting to watch.
Yeah.
My only complaint is that it may have gone on a little bit too long and had like one or like three quarters too many big set pieces and chase scenes, but the cumulative effect, maybe I'm wrong about that, because I think the cumulative effect, it's important to have seen all of the horrible throes of this dying creature, unable to control its predatory drive when before it was just a trees and leaves eater. Fang and Spear's terror, their traumatized exhaustion is all conveyed very beautifully, but I think that you need the cumulative power of watching this creature that, yes, it's trying to kill our heroes, but you have this strange, like, compassion for it as it is thrashing its last in this lava pit. Then the cellos come in and the ashes begin to fall and it turns from red to gray. That's something that Tartakovsky has always done really well in terms of the sound design. Like, how many of my favorite Samurai Jack episodes came down to knowing for a fact that he had pulled a certain bird call from like a certain part of New Jersey that I was like, oh yeah, okay, he was in the Watchung Mountains and those are baby cardinals. That's amazing. How did he do that? Like, I recognize those frogs. I don't actually know where he's from, but there is something about the sound design and the relentlessness sometimes of the, not negativity, but of, in Samurai Jack's case, the just like, I'm never in my own time, I can't seem to beat Aku, and yet I must continue. And in this case, you're just beset always by danger, apparently, of the most florid kind. So I think it all works together to create a very emotional, moving experience in 23 or 24 minutes. I liked the moments of rest. Fang is basically communicating like, if you want to do that, all right, but you're crazy and I'm not going, and like kind of folds her teeny arms, mm-hmm. like metaphorically, mm-hmm. and then consents to go, and then they like kick over a couple pebbles and it's like, oh. I like that this kind of art still exists in animation and TV that's just like very thoughtful as to scene setting within the constraints of this format to evoke. And he's one of the best there is, I think. So thank you for reminding me that this existed, and I believe taking up 30 half hours of my time in the very near future, because I'm excited to get back into it.
It's so good. I promise you will not be disappointed. It's amazing. Amazing show.
I'll go next. Right. The joke in our household is that Sandy thinks she is Dave's wife, Sandy, our dog. And so it was fun to see in Primal that Fang really kind of is Spear's wife in every way that matters. The two of them do have a very loving, mutually supportive, occasionally, as Sarah said, suspicious partnership. Speaking to the constraints that he's chosen to impose on this project, like Sarah also said, is a great way to think of this. And the range of emotions that he can evoke in the viewer in this, you know, it feels long at times just because it's so relentless and so grim. But it's, you know, well under a half hour in actuality and very remarkable. My notes include this fucked up little dinosaur is too upsetting. And I stand by that. It's the first. Yeah. The first guy that stumbles out of the woods and, you know, quickly collapses.
I just want to make a note on one of the reasons why the infected version of all the dinosaurs are so creepy.
Yeah.
And one of the big contributors is the slightly melted strawberry swirl candy eyes that they give them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just like such a good design choice. It was just like so alien and like it can't be anything other than madness, right?
Yes. That plus their naked spines are showing through out of their bodies.
Clearly suffering. They're,
yes. They're not having a great time. No. And especially, as Omar said, you know, the transition from the bucolic peacefulness of this Argentinosaurus herd, you know, they really are just chilling. And then all of a sudden, like, horror comes to town in the form of this bite infecting their buddy, who then, like, kills all of them and their potential future young as well. By the time they get to the lava field and infected dinosaur, like, falls in and then pops out again, it's like, oh, God. Just die. Like, it's so.
I know.
It really is. It really does. Like, it hooks you so intensely. So, all of those parts are great. But they also, the way they insert humor as well, like Sarah said, there's a moment when they're both sort of fang and spear peeking over the ridge where they've taken shelter in a cave to hide from this infected dinosaur that may or may not be dead at this point. And they both sort of like peek over. You just see the tops of their heads, both of them. And it's like really cute. There's another part. He and Fang are both running. But like he's pumping his arms like back and forth in a very classic cartoony way while his face remains completely stoic. Like it's not like a Scooby-Doo run. And yet it is kind of. That was really well done too. Like the way character notes come into this almost entirely nonverbal production and the verbal we do here we don't understand is really remarkable for what it can achieve. And at the end of it, I did say to Dave, I would watch this. Like this, it sort of reminded me of Scavenger's Reign, also on HBO Max, a wonderful one season show that was robbed of a second season. It's a similar sort of a thing, but very different in the particulars, but similar vibe, I would say. So yeah, this was great. Again, I'll echo what Sarah said. Thank you for bringing it to us, Dave.
Yeah, I thought it was really great, despite it being incredibly disturbing. Mm-hmm. Like at the end, because like these guys are all good doogies.
Yeah.
And the good doogie got bit in the leg, and then the good doogie became prehistoric yeller, and then we had to put prehistoric yeller down.
Yeah.
That's kind of the episode.
Basically.
Except there's lava fields that old yeller falls into that comes back up to, all really angry and red. So there's a lot of upsetting visuals, but they're super effective and they're not salacious. Because there's an emotional underpinning to all this, it doesn't feel like a Fangoria magazine, you know, put to screen. It feels like everything has a purpose. So I was really impressed by how much they did with the constraints they put upon themselves. When Omar said, I'm coming back at you, another zero English dialogue tandem pitch after a Shogun.
This is I'm now like, Omar's lane.
This is what he does now. And I knew about the existence of this show, but I hadn't watched it. And I loved it. I thought it was really great, really affecting. And the visuals and the character designs were top notch. The way that when something gets infected, they sort of like turn into a rat fink illustration of themselves was disgusting. And really well done. And again, those creepy eyes and their skin that's always bubbling, no matter what they do. Plague of it was really well designed. And then there's this thing, and it's just being driven by whatever's happening in his brain now. And there's a scene where he's chasing him through a canyon in a true sort of like 70s cop chase in a TV show fashion. One car can get out of the alley because it's a small little Japanese import, but the giant police cruiser can't, and it gets crushed and, you know, it can't get all the way through. And that's the dinosaur at the end of this canyon.
Yep.
But then it just like is driven and just keeps on trying to get out of the fucking canyon. It's just like ripping the back half of its flesh just completely off to do so. So it's just these brutal moments like that that really sell everything that's going on in this episode. And I thought it was really well done. And I'm absolutely up to starting this from the start and see where it goes.
Thank you. I will say real quick, if you do watch it from the beginning and see it through, Fang and Spear is one of the great TV love stories. I mean, I think their relationship just evolves and grows. And by the end of the second season, you're like, I would take a bullet for either of these characters. Like, I love these characters.
Amazing.
All right, let's make this official. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you, Primal?
I say, that means yes.
Darn.
Yes for me as well.
Me too. So, that means Primal Season 1, Episode 7, Plague of Madness. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover who is our winner and loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winners.
I do. It is pit performers. First up is that Star Trek is getting a table read, celebrating the WGA Foundation's 60th anniversary. I think there will be a live stream of this as well. Noah Wiley and Catherine Lanasa, among others from the pit, will be performing that. And the second one is Lisa Ann Walter is hosting the Astro TV Awards. And at those awards, Sean Hitosi is receiving the Virtuoso Award for his work on the pit. The Astro Awards recognize performers who, quote, make an impact. So it's kind of broad and people's choicey, but why not? Hitosi has been underrated for a while, and let's correctly rate him for a while instead. Bring him up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Tara, who is our loser of the week?
Our loser of the week is Ego Nwodum. She invited Jason Biggs, who is one of the hosts of Dinner and a Movie in the 2020s, onto her podcast, which is called Thanks, Dad. On said podcast, he elected to tell the world he is a foot guy, not something I ever wanted to know, and also show his own toes. This guy is constantly, I mean, he knows how to get attention for oversharing, and this is not the first time he's done it. When he and his, I believe, on her way to being ex-wife, they are separated, Jenny Mollen, like years ago, they made news for going on, I believe, a different podcast and saying, oh, she engaged the services of a sex worker for his birthday. It's like, again, this is not my business. Like,
no.
Keep to yourselves.
Can't unknow it.
But
thanks.
He didn't. Now that's knowledge I will have for the rest of my life about Jason Biggs and his foot fetish.
Well, speaking about knowledge you're going to have for the rest of your life, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It's game time. Welcome back to Game Time. Holy moly, 10th of the season. Whoa. Scores are Tara 4, Sarah 3, Value Guest 2.
Oh my god.
Today we are playing Shop the Show. It comes from Mr. Dan Casino.
Damn you, Casino!
Who earns himself a free shirt from the ESG store at throughmethods.com.
Are there any more left that he does not already have? You're going to have to design some.
Oh, I made some just for him.
Oh, good.
So that maybe there are a couple that he doesn't have yet. There's one that says, my name is Dan Casino, and I'd rather be collecting presidential flashcards and something else than doing whatever.
Well,
and he wore it to the mall, so.
That's true. We did get that information. Yeah. Well, if he doesn't have a New Jersey Charm School shirt, now's the time.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right. Dan writes, every time I turn on Peacock, it urges me to shop the show and buy products seen on a TV show, replicas of props, etc. But how much should we be paying for this stuff? In this game, I'm going to give you a brief description of a real TV tie-in product or prop replica or something of the sort that you can buy, and you have to guess the price using popular pricing-based game show rules, so closest to the pin without going over. Everyone bids on every product. You bid whole dollars. I rounded everything up for my sanity, and we'll rotate who goes first, so everybody gets the first crack at it. Here's how the points work. Closest to the pin will get 1 point. But then, based on how close you were to the actual price, you will get bonus points. We have gold, silver, and bronze tier. A bullseye is gold, gets you 4 points. Something silver will get you 2 points. And then bronze range will get you 1 point. How far away you need to be will change with the round, so I will explain that when we get there, but that's how you play. All right. We're going to throw it to Piggy to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Omar is our guessing order today, and we'll rotate who goes first for each question for the opening bids. No steel mills, no growth worth equalizer challenge zones. 21 questions today. Are we ready to play Shop the Show?
Yes.
All right. This is round one. All your items are $50 or less.
Okay.
Everybody listen. Everybody's going to put a bid in on this. Here is your TV product. Days of Our Lives. A green polyester apron advertising Brady's Pub. It's an apron, so if you get slapped and spill something, it'll keep your clothes clean.
Oh.
All right. So, Tara, you have opening bid here. How much does that cost? Round it up to the nearest dollar is how I did the math there.
$29.
Okay. Sarah D. Bunting.
$22.
And Omar.
That was my guess. $30.
Come on.
All right, I can tell you that the bullseye nobody got was 35. Woo. If it wasn't for as close as the pin, that would have been a 0 point affair. But Omar, you are technically the closest. So Omar gets 1 point, and that's all the points we're going to give out for question one.
Oh, okay. Damn. All right.
Sarity Bunting, you will open the bidding for this one. Grey's Anatomy product. A replica of the blue post-it note that served as Meredith and Derek's wedding vows. It is a 5.5-inch square sticker that looks like a post-it note. Mm-hmm. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, think about that. How much do you have to pay for that replica post-it note?
$8.
Omar?
$4.
Tara?
I wrote down $50 and I'm standing by it. I think they're going to charge more.
$50. All right, here how... Wow. All right. The bullseye, nobody got it. It was 10, which means Tara is well over... Sarah is the closest and became within two. So you get silver points, 2 bonus points. Omar, you were too far away. Nothing for you.
All right.
Good job, Sarah.
Omar, you're going to start us off bidding for Love Island merchandise, a chunky gold-colored bracelet with 2 bands, one reading love and the other reading lust. How much are you going to pay for that Love Island chunky gold-colored bracelet?
$19.
$19 from Omar. Tara?
$15.
$15 from Tara and Sarah.
$29.
Here comes the results. 1 point only for Omar. Ooh. The actual target was $25. Nobody got that. Sarah was over. Tara well under. And Omar with 19 closest to the pin for 1 point.
Okay.
Tara,
yep.
Saturday Night Live, a replica of the Mr. Bill doll, bendable and posable, 4 inches tall with an internal wire structure so he can hold a pose. How much are you paying for that?
$19.
Sarah?
$17.
Omar?
$22.
$22. Here we go. The bullseye was 16, which means no points. Everyone went over.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. Oh, look at this. Opening bid for Brady Bunch merchandise.
Oh.
A full-scale replica of the cursed tiki idol from the Hawaii trip.
Da-da-da-da.
Made of solid resin with a rope attached. How much are you paying for a replica of the Brady tiki idol?
$13.
$13. Omar?
$17.
$17 from Omar. Tar?
$23.
Here we go. The actual price, Tara. $22.
Oh, man.
Sarah too far away for closest the pin, so Omar picks up 1 more point for his guess of $17, $5 off.
Nice.
Moving to Omar for the opening bid for this piece of merchandise from The Office. It's a white mug that reads World's Best Boss, just like the one Michael Scott has. 15-ounce capacity, microwave, and dishwasher safe. A white mug from The Office, Omar. How much you paying?
$18.
$18 from Omar. Tara?
$12.
$12. And Sarah?
$16.
Ooh, all right. The actual price was...
$19. Omar, very close. Everybody else out of the zone. So Omar picks up 1 point for closest to the pin, plus 2 additional points for being just one off.
Woo! Woo.
Nicely done. All right, 3 point pickup for Omar. This is the last question of round one.
Okay.
The Prisoner. A very large, 4 feet when inflated, off-white balloon. Put a lot of helium in it, and it will bounce like the rover from the show.
Are you serious? This is something you can buy?
That's crazy. You can buy.
Okay.
So how much for the Prisoner Rover balloon? And we're going to start with Tara.
$30
from Tara.
$6.
Ooh, 36. Sarah.
44.
And Omar.
$28.
$28. I can tell you that it was $40. Mm. Sarah went $4 over. Tara went $4 under, so she will pick up the only point today, closest to the pin. Omar, $12 off.
On the board.
All right, that is round one. It's time for the scores, please.
All right, I have me with 1 point, Sarah with 3, Omar on the lead with 6. Sarah, need to concur.
I got Sarah with 2.
I had myself a 2.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've got 1, 2, and 6.
Okay.
Okay. It is time for round two. The products now cost between $30 and $100.
Okay.
Otherwise, same rules. The thresholds, instead of being 1 and 2, are now 2 and 5 for gold and bronze.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting, start us off. It is from Batman 66. It is a replica Batarang made of solid iron painted blue with a branded display stand approximately 6 inches across. How much are you paying for that, do you think?
$59.
$59. Omar.
$40.
$40 from Omar and Tara.
$50. Period.
The price was $45, which means Omar picks up 1 point for closest to the pin and another point for being just $5 away, right on the threshold of bronze. And Omar will start off the bidding for another one from Love Island, a set of Burning Love press-on nails, 10 nails in pink and red patterns. Comes with glue stickers and an alcohol pad. How much are you paying for the Love Island Burning Love press-on nails set, Omar?
$30.
Tara?
Ugh. $31. Oh. I was also going to say $30.
$33.
I can tell you that at a price of $45, that Sarah D. Bunting picked up the sole point for closest to the pin.
Good job, Sarah.
Wow.
Guess what's next, guys?
Jesus.
It's a product from Love Island.
Okay.
It is for Tara to open the bidding for a set of Love Island branded scrunchies. Three pattern scrunchies made of mulberry silk.
$32.
Sarah?
$42.
And Omar?
$36.
The actual price, $50, which means we're only going to award closest to the pin, which goes to Sarah D. Bunting, 1 point.
Well, wow. Good job, Sarah.
Love Island, fuck off.
It heard rude. You because we are now on to NCIS. We're going to be bidding navally, Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh,
yay.
On a blue... A navy blue, see, they're even doing blue navally. Mm. A navy blue NCIS unisex windbreaker, as seen on the long-running show. Polyester with fleece interior.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm adding this to my list of possible gifts for Sarah D. Bunching for Christmas. Go ahead, Sarah.
All right, how much will Tara be spending on you for Christmas for that item?
Navally.
Between $30 and $100.
Oh, my God. $65.
Omar.
$70 navally.
And Tara.
Yeah, sorry, C bucks, I forgot to say.
$45. Okay, you all underbid quite a bit.
Really?
It's going to cost you $91.
Whoa.
Okay, sand scratches dollars? It off list.
45, 65, 70. Omar gets 1 point for closest to the pin.
It's too much to get someone for a bit.
Omar, the next TV show is Survivor, and you're bidding on a replica tribal council voting pen.
It's black marker with plastic casing designed to look like wood. How much are you spending for one survivor replica tribal council voting pen?
You better not be spending more than
$35. $32.
I'm going to say 32 again.
All right. And Sarah?
37.
All right. Pretty close guesses for $40 pen.
Wow.
So that means 2 points for Sarah for closest to the pin plus a bronze guess and another bronze guess for Omar for 1 point. Two to Sarah, one to Omar. Next show, starting off with Tara for the bidding, it's The Walking Dead. A hardwood replica of Lucille, the bat that Negan uses to great effect. It's covered in blunted barbed wire and painted red. Painted red with what?
Boy.
How much are you spending on that replica bat?
The future murder bat. Weapon. $57.
$57 to Sarah?
$63.
And to Omar?
$70.
$70 even. Omar was definitely the closest to 76.
Whoa.
Omar gets 1 point for closest to the pin, and that's it for points.
Okay.
This is the last question of round two. Sarah will start the bidding for this item from Twisted Metal. Remember Twisted Metal?
Oh, yes.
Will Arnett as a big gargantuan clown dude.
Sweet Tooth.
A reversible bucket hat that says Sweet Tooth. You know, like the evil clown on that show, who I don't think wears a hat. 100% polyester. How much are you spending for the Twisted Metal Sweet Tooth bucket hat? Bucket hats, reversible and back in style.
It's like two hats in one. Keep that in mind with your bidding.
All right, Sarah, we're opening the bidding with you.
Yeah, I have a feeling this is going to be like shockingly high. So 44.
Omar.
34.
Tara.
I mean, I really was going to say 35, but now I can't. So I'll say 38. Because it's a dick move and I already did it
exactly.
Once.
All right. The guesses are in. I can tell you that nobody got $43. Sarah D. Bunting, $1 over.
Damn it.
And Tara just squeaking in on the bronze tier for 1 point, plus being closest to the pin, total two.
Okay.
That's round two. Nice. One round left, 7 questions left. Let's get the scores thus far.
All right. I have me with 3, Sarah with 6, Omar with 11. Sarah, do you concur?
I also concur.
I concur.
The spreadsheet with all the math agrees with you.
Thank you, spreadsheet.
Round three, $100 to $1,000.
Oh, fuck.
Can't wait to hear if anything hits that threshold.
Omar, here we go. Battlestar Galactica, the old one.
The ship. It flies.
A scale replica of the Viper helmet worn by Dirk Benedict with LED lights and a base that's signed by Benedict himself. It even has interior fabric lining to make it more comfortable to wear. The thresholds are changing for round three. This is now within $10 to get a silver hit and $20 for your bronze hit.
Okay.
All right. Battlestar Galactica Viper helmet. How much are you paying for that? Omar.
$249.
$249? Tara?
$115.
$115 for Tara and Sarah D. Bunting.
$229.
Well, I can tell you we're all quite a ways away from $1,000 even.
What?
Oh, Jesus.
What are you doing with your
That's
life?
Make crazy.
Your own suckers.
That means
oh my
Omar
God.
Was closest to the pin
Jesus.
By $751.
I thought we were in a recession.
Yeah. 1 point for Omar.
All right. Good job, Omar.
Tara, start us off with this item from House of the Dragon. It is a scale replica of the crown of King Vizigigigiga. The one on TV was made of a lightweight resin, but this one is made of real metal and comes with a display stand as worn on the show by Vizir something Targaryen. All right. We're going to start this off with Tara. What is your bidding for this crown?
I mean, hearing the number on that fucking replica helmet really changed this game for me. And yet I'm still going to say $380.
$380 is Tara's bid to Sarah.
$399.
That's how you bid. That's a real dick move, Sarah. I can't believe you did that. Omar.
$500.
$500 even from Omar. I can tell you nobody bullseyed.
350. No points. 380 too much. 399 too much. 500 too much.
But the Battlestar Galactica helmet. $1,000.
Sarah D. Bunting, start us off with our last item from Love Island. It costs between $100 and $1,000.
Oh, my God.
It is a Luna B branded metallic copper bikini that claims to be the epitome of glamour. Ooh, okay. La la.
I was going to say it's 5 scrunchies if it's over 100, but this is close.
Yeah.
It's either Love or the Island.
Sarah D. Bunting, you're starting off bidding.
119.
Omar?
150.
Tara?
I'm going to say 125.
Why do you keep on bidding in between them? Ooh, weird. Weird strategy. All right. I can tell you nobody got close to the actual price of $275.
Get the fuck out of here.
Which means that Omar, with the highest bid of 150, will earn himself 1 point here. Mm. I don't think mathematically anybody can catch up at this point. Well, I guess you could if you start hitting some bullseyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Omar, start us off with the Twilight Zone's item. It is an 18-inch Taki Tina doll. The doll is black and white, just like on the TV, and says all the creepy stuff she says in her episode. Taki Tina doll, Twilight Zone. How much for that?
175.
That's literally exactly what I was going to say.
Tara?
160.
So we have 175 and 160?
That's right.
Yes.
I really was going to say 159. So
say it.
It doesn't matter because we're both going to lose. 159.
I am here to tell you the actual price is $230 for that doll. Omar closest. 1 point. That's all we get. Omar with a lot of 1 point pickups here.
Omar, do you have an eBay store where you sell collectibles? Because I'm starting to get suspicious of how
I'm
good you are.
I'm very good at shopping, and I shop a lot online.
An actual dinosaur from Primal costs this.
Three questions left. God.
Okay.
This is question 19.
Costs $19.
Tara will open up the bidding for this item from Thundercats. Thundercats, okay. Thundercats, ho.
Sure.
Sure, you could buy a soft foam replica of the Sword of Omens, but this is the real thing. A little more than 100 centimeters long with a steel blade and finishes that look show accurate. Mm. The product listing notes that it is actually sharp and should be kept away from children. Mm-hmm. All right, Sword of Omens replica from Thundercats. Tara, how much is that going to set you back? It's somewhere between $100 and $1,000.
$400.
Sarah?
$799.
Omar?
Show accurate, but the show is animated?
I was going to say.
Excuse me?
It's made of paper.
Let's go big, $850.
I can now report the actual price for the Sword of Omens replica is $600. Only one not to go over, Tara, but she was $200 under, picks up 1 point. Omar style. Sarah D. Bunting, start us off with this item from Watch What Happens Live. The Clubhouse Shot Ski.
I was going to guess that. Mm-hmm.
It's a ski.
Oh, shit.
I don't know what any of this means. Glasses. I see. It's a ski with holders for shot glasses and comes with 4 Watch What Happens Live shot glasses. Mm-hmm. Seems to be the size of an actual ski made of hardwood. That's a lot. All right. So I guess the ski shot sampler plank from Bravo, how much is that going to set you back, Sarah?
And what comes with shot glasses, after all? Yeah. 220.
Omar.
I'll pay a lot for shipping, too.
It's just the price, the sticker price. You don't have to pay. Shipping is not part of this.
But we got
to
add that. Add that later. 350.
He's thinking about it because he's actually going to order this.
Yeah, I'm actually going to buy this, yeah.
I was once again really going to say 350. Instead, I will say 410.
410. Here we go. Y'all overbid.
Damn it.
Some more than others. Sarah D. Bunting, you're $20 off $200.
Wow.
Okay.
So no points in that round. Last question, everybody.
Okay.
The scores currently are, according to me and my spreadsheet, Tara Ariano with 4.
Yep.
Sarah D. Bunting with 6.
Yep.
Omar with 14.
Yep. Okay. That's what I have to.
Zing, zang, zoodle. All right, last one,
Supermarket
Omar.
Supermarket swept.
Let's make it official.
Yellowstone, Omar.
A replica of the hat John Dutton, that's Cosner, wore on Yellowstone. Made to order with a buckskin body and a braided horsehair band. Replica Yellowstone hat. Contains no Kevin Costner DNA.
$199
from Omar. Tara.
It has to be price that you want to spend it on your dad for a difficult gifting.
I'm just going to repeat, occasion. Made to order.
Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm going to say $499.
Sarah? Last opportunity, guys, to get a bullseye.
$229.
Actual price, that hat costs $640.
Fucking no.
Sorry, Dad.
No,
not getting one of these. Loves their dad that much.
Tara Ariandel closest to the pin for 1 point. Wow, that whole round was all just 1 point carries.
Except boy.
Zero. Couple zeros.
Right, yes.
All no rules right, at all. Is regulation. Oof. Let's get the scores.
I finished with 5. Mm-hmm. Sarah had 6.
Yep.
Omar, 14.
That is correct.
Ooh, yeah.
Whoa. All right. Want to play the tiebreaker?
Sure.
All right. We'll let Tara. We'll go Tara, Sarah, Omar. Suppose that you wanted to spend the night in the actual cabin used for Rip Wheeler, played by Cole Hauser, sure, on Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. How much does it cost per night to rent the cabin, which sleeps 4 and is situated with beautiful views in the middle of nowhere? How much per night is that going to set you back? All right, we're going to go to Tara first.
$800.
$800 a night. Sarah?
$3,000 a night.
Ooh, $3,000. Quite the range. Omar?
$450.
And $450. Omar looking for a bargain. This always will cost you $1,700 a night. So Sarah, well over. Tara is the closest to the pin with $800 versus Omar's $450. Tara picks up one steel meal for future use.
Well done.
But let's not forget, Omar won the day.
Valued guest.
Valued guest.
Thank you, Dan. Always loved the Price is Right games.
Yes.
So much fun.
Uh-huh.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We flew the coup with the National Parks law enforcement drama and a pigeon. Before going around the dial with stops at The Last House, X-Men 97, and Game Day Murders. Omar took us back in time for the brutal Plague of Madness primal episode for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Omar was the winner of this week's Game Time from Mr. Dan Casino. Next up, it's Reacher, the man who reaches on this Friday's Extra, Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
Ah. I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara.
I'm not leaving her to the vultures, Jeff with a G.
Sarah.
The floor literally is lava.
And Omar. Just so you know, Omar, I actually do copy the video just for archives. That's it. We'll see you next time.
See? Take only memories, leave only footprints. Easy, right?